Hello and welcome to Life's Rosie, the podcast that will hold your hand through your breakup recovery, take you from rock bottom to reinvention and help you survive and then thrive. Today, I'm joined by Helen Thorne, who is one half of the hugely popular comedy duo Scummy Mummies and author of the book Get Divorced, Be Happy. She is someone I admire hugely. She's honest, she's thoughtful and she's pee your pants funny. You absolutely want to be her mate. But her marriage split was definitely not funny. It was shocking and devastating and her whole world imploded. And in her book, she has brilliantly documented the journey and its mix of raw accounts of pain and bewilderment, lols at her sexploits and everything in between. But if I have to choose one thing that Helen has done for those of us who are going through a marriage split, it's that she redefines it not as a tragedy, but as an opportunity. She says the worldview is shifting and a woman without a partner is not tragic, but instead liberated. Somebody to be admired and envied rather than pitied. Helen offers hope, comfort and inspiration to anyone going through a bad breakup. Anyway, I will stop rambling and say hello to her. Welcome, Helen.
Oh, thank you very much.
We probably need to start right at the beginning, which is obviously the more painful stuff. And I know your journey is one of sort of hope and inspiration and actually emerging the other side, feeling amazing. But I guess, you know, for everybody out there who's listening, could we start with, you don't have to go into the sort of nitty gritty, but the sort of the basically how your marriage split occurred and whether it was a shock or whether it was something you could see coming.
Okay. All right. I'll do the quick potted history of Helen becoming single. So I met my ex-husband when I was 19 at university and he was my first kind of real boyfriend. And we fell in love and we got married 10 years later, had two children, and I'm the daughter of a vicar. So I grew up, you know, with the sanctity of marriage and my parents have been together for 58 years. And so I was a really strong believer in marriage and I just thought he was it. That was it forever. And we did two bouts of couples counseling and I worked really hard. And then one day, Rosie, one day I was getting a World Book Day costume together for my daughter. And she wanted to be Doctor Who because everyone knows that's a very famous book. And I said, oh, I think Daddy's blazer, I think that'd be good. And I picked up the jacket next to our bed and in that pocket was a love letter. And it was not from me. It was from someone else. And, you know, I'm sure I don't have to describe these feelings, but it was just like my blood ran cold. Everything changed. I went, fuck, he's not the man I know. Like my whole world kind of exploded. And my daughter saw me read this letter. It was very clear from the letter that the affair had been going on for a very long time and there was intentions to stay together. And she said, what's that, mummy? And I said, it's nothing. And she said, that doesn't look like nothing. And then I sort of shoved the letter in my back pocket. And then sort of that was sort of just before dinner and he was just about to come home. And then he came home and I went, can you just come upstairs with me for a minute? And he came upstairs.
Oh, my God. I can imagine you must have been shaking because it's almost like you disassociate from your body, isn't it? You kind of...
Yeah, it was just... I just felt sick. And I texted a couple of girlfriends in Australia because I knew they'd be awake. And I was just like, fuck, what do I do? What do I do? And I sent them a screenshot of the letter. And then I sent, come upstairs. And I sat him down on the bed and I threw the letter on the bed and said, good one, dickhead, it's over. And I knew instantly... 22 years was gone. Like it had to be over. There was no question that it had to be done. And I just went, what the fuck do I do now? Like we're the path and everything. We were 5 days off signing a mortgage for 200 grand to renovate our house. We'd been working during the same time he'd been having an affair on this big house renovation and all this stuff. And I just think there was some divine intervention. Some lady, some wonderful guru in the world that went, Helen can't go into lockdown and she can't go into massive debt with this dickhead. And so I was saved from all sorts of mess. And so, 3 weeks later, we went into lockdown. He moved into a flat down the road and I collapsed. And so I had 3 months of lockdown, not getting any hugs from any adults, you know, doing it all by myself.
Oh, my God.
I was in like heartbreak boot camp because I was sort of isolated, I guess, from any distractions. I couldn't really work. I'm a touring comedian, but I'm also a very
So actually you were grappling
person.
With two lots of uncertainty. You'd lost the main certainty and then you're a comedian. And so actually you're... you know, you were not earning, presumably, and you were not getting the validation from the audience and doing what you love to do.
Yes, I know. I'm an absolute tart for attention. So I think we had like a 40-date tour that had to be, it was either cancelled or postponed, which we're doing some of the gigs now, 2 years later. But it was just horrific. And I just remembered, and I'm sure lots of people have gone through affairs, just yelling at him saying, was this not enough? You know, you've got these beautiful children. And we've just been in Australia seeing family, had a beautiful holiday. I had no idea this had been going on for so many years. And it was such a shock. And I was like, but I worked so hard and I didn't do anything wrong. And I think the infuriating thing about going through what I've gone through and when you experience an affair is like, fuck, I've got to have less money. You know, everything has to change. Yeah. And I have to be the good lady and not make a fuss or all those sort of things. But I did nothing wrong. And that's what I found really infuriating.
And I think you're right. That's something that we all, you know, and actually society rewards, you know, the sort of stiff upper lip and the woman that just kind of keeps it all together and, you know, it makes it easier for the guy to bugger off, basically.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, did all those things, never slagged him off in front of the kids, all that sort of stuff. And for the first couple of weeks, we sort of did this thing where he'd come back from work, we'd have dinner together, he'd put the kids to bed. And once they were asleep, then he'd go and stay at a hotel. So we sort of kept it so it wasn't a massive shock for the children. But I couldn't, it was too painful to see him anymore. And I thought the kids need to know and we need to move on. And Corona had started sort of buzzing around. Yeah, so we sat the kids down and told them. And they were so shocked.
Was that incredibly painful? I think that was my worst moment, actually.
Yeah, it was. It was really hard. And I just remember I'm sitting at the table that we did it, actually, right now, just looking at them. They were watching telly. And I thought, I'm just about to change your life. Because, you know, I know whatever I'm going to tell you now. We'll set you in a different path. And, so we sat down and we'd rehearsed it. Like, we'd written down what we wanted to say and we'd actually sort of discussed about the best way we thought we could do that. But the kids kept going, why are you splitting up? And, you know, they were in just as much shock as I was. And, you know, we did all the things about telling them we loved them and it was down to mummy and daddy. But then we had to sit them down a few weeks later and say, look, he said, oh, daddy met another woman and he didn't tell mummy and that was the wrong thing. And there are consequences.
Okay, so he did fess up to that. That must have been at least something.
Yeah, I think so. And I think children need a reason. And like when I was doing research for my book, I interviewed Philippa Perry and she said, if children don't have a reason, then they will make up a reason and then they'll blame themselves. And I just didn't want them to blame themselves for that. And we just told them enough information, they're 10 and 13, that was the reason why. And I didn't get into a point going, it's his fault. We just said, this is very sad, but we're going to do the best we can to make sure you have a very happy life. And then they told us how long they wanted to stay with me 5 days a week and they'll see him two nights a week. So we sort of worked it out from there. But yeah, it was the pandemic, which was really weird. So I'd have 5 days of homeschooling Monday to Friday. And then I have two days at home alone, rattling around with the Chardonnay and my fags. Yeah. going, what the fuck is going on?
Oh my God, without being able to go out and get pissed with your girlfriend. Helen, can I just rewind a minute? Because I think the big difference, one of the big differences between you and I was you obviously had that moment where you were like, okay, this is totally over now, you've done it. And to me, I sort of envy your strength at that point because I was so desperate to cling on to, you know, and part of me always thinks, you know, was it love for him or was it actually just, you know, was it, I just didn't want I didn't want the house to blow up. I didn't want the kids to be upset. You know, so where do you think did that require strength? Was it like you really wanted him to put his arms around you and say, I'm sorry, and I'll make it work out? Or did you just kind of knew, did you, at that point?
Yeah. And it was really strange when he walked into the house, he looked different. I thought, you are not who I thought you were, or maybe the projections of the good husband I wanted him to be. And then suddenly the guard was dropped down. I thought, God, you don't care about me at all. You just care about yourself. And and so that I found in a way kind of easy and freeing because I just thought, I can't have this. I can't have you anywhere near me again. I don't want to be hurt anymore. This has to end. Yeah.
And so, did that mean you didn't do all that stuff that, you know, the sort of stalking of trying to find out who the other woman was, or the kind of, you know, getting into the why? Was it something I've done? Have I failed? Was I not a good enough wife? You know, I remember somebody saying to me, did you not give him enough blowjobs, helpfully? I mean, you know, it's like, actually, did you do any of that?
No, I didn't actually. I was too fucked off that I gave him so many of my years, and I was really angry. I thought, how dare you? I gave you all my love, all my faithfulness, all my loyalty, and you just took what you wanted. You took from me the kids and the house, and you know, you had that arrangement, and then you went off and fucked someone you wanted. And so and I just thought, God, I just felt robbed and felt really used. And I think that anger was what kind of determined my strength. There was something in me. And I'm quite a people-pleasing, warm, bubbly person. But at that moment, I thought, no way. And he didn't beg forgiveness. And I thought,
that's interesting, isn't it? It's like...
Yeah, and I think that helped. And he just looked sad. And I said, why didn't you tell me? And he said, I just didn't want you to know. I wanted this and I wanted that. And I thought, that's disgusting. You know, how do you think that... Why do you think I don't deserve to be loved properly? And I think that's when I went bovine, like I got on all fours and kind of went, fuck, I haven't experienced real love. And that felt cruel.
Oh, so you retrospect, you look back and you thought, well, actually he didn't love me in that sense.
No, he didn't. Okay,
that's really hard. I don't think I feel that actually. Mm. I feel like our love changed, and then obviously it was just hideous at the end, but I don't feel that. So that must be very tough actually.
Yeah. And I in some ways I feel like an idiot. I thought, oh God, no, you were always wanting romance and he never gave it to you. And I made all the effort for the dinners and all that sort of stuff. And he was, you know, the last sort of romantic thing that we did was went away for our anniversary, but Ellie, my comedy partner, had booked the hotel and cause she knew how much I wanted that romance. And she helped my ex-husband, you know, book this lovely place to go away. And, you know, I should have, and this is in the book, 1 year, I think it was for St. Valentine's Day, actually, he wrote in a card, here are the 5 things that I love about you. And then he wrote 2 things. And at the bottom he wrote, actually, I could only think of 2 things, you know, happy St. Valentine's Day. And he actually gave it to me. So I was like, but this sort of felt symbolic in that he got 2 out of the 5 things he wanted in life from me. And he went out externally for the other things. And we did laugh about it at the time on the podcast and go, oh God, men are so hopeless. But now I look back and I'm like, who gives a card like that? So, yeah.
It's so hard, isn't it? Because I think there are so many men that have been taught not to express their emotions, and they just don't have the same words. There's a friend of mine whose husband, not husband at the time, brilliantly wrote a Valentine's card that just said, cheers. Which I thought was quite classic. So that is, you know, that's written. So how did you... You were obviously in lockdown and it must have been, it's a very sort of strange recovery journey, as it were, because, you know, most of us go out and get lashed with our girlfriends or go and do an exercise class or go on holiday or do all of those things. I mean, I think I went on holiday a gazillion times.
Yeah.
So it must be so, that must have been so hard for you. But do you think actually it helped that you had to kind of, as the therapist would say, sit with your feelings?
Yes, exactly. And I remember talking to the divine Helen Russell about this because I wanted to interview her, because I'm not very good at being sad and I'm not very good at being angry, and there was nowhere to hide, and I'm in the house that we lived in, so there's all the memories, and I remember going through all the photos and like separating the photos off and giving him that pile. So I did have to very much face being sad and angry, and I had to get better at it. And I just remember in the first few months we actually once a week had a phone call with a therapist so I could actually talk to him, because I made this decision. I thought, I've got to be in this man's life and he has to be in my life for the next, you know, 10, 20 years with the kids. I need to be able to talk to him without wanting to kill him. So during that time, every week I'd sort of save up all the things I needed to say, and then we would speak with a therapist and I felt heard. It wasn't just me kind of going, what the fuck, all the time. Yeah. There were some constructive ways in which we could move forward and communicate.
God, that is really impressive. You sound like you're going to get like the A star on how to navigate a separation.
Oh,
with a complete douchebag.
Yes, I know. So it was very helpful. And I had my own therapist as well. So everything was sort of on Zoom. You know, I'd have drinks nights with friends on Zoom. But I did hit the booze pretty hard. And especially on the weekends when the kids went around, as soon as the car was out of the drive and him driving the kids away, it'd be like fag in one hand, bottle of white wine in the other. And, you know, that was a way of escaping my feelings as well. You know, I'd drink and then, you know, fall asleep two nights a week, which wasn't great, but it is a way of coping. And I didn't really get into exercise until about 6 months afterwards. But, it, you know, needs must and all those things. But I think, and I was really lucky that I'm Australian. And so at 3 a.m. in the morning, when all the thoughts are racing through your head and you're, I remember once I woke up at 3 a.m. I went, I bet they did anal. That's why I went with her.
And then you need to call a friend, because I think that's mad. Sort of, yeah, exactly. I mean, I feel like I owe my friends for the rest of my life, because it took me quite a long time to. I remember when the kids were little, they talk about self-soothing, and I think I realized that as soon as anything happened, like with my ex or with the children, or, you know, I would need to phone a friend. And then, like, obviously now I've got to the stage where if something happens, I can kind of process it by myself mainly. But I guess that's brilliant. You've got friends on two time zones.
Yes. And that's what I would recommend to the listener. Yeah. Get somebody on the other side of the world. So that was really great. And I have an amazing sister and my mom, and also Ellie just kind of held me together, even though we were like 2 meters apart. Like, she'd come and drive, sit in my driveway, and I'd wave to her from the car, and it was really beautiful. God. But I speak about this quite a lot. I thought, just finding out that just one person didn't love me, it just enlightened me about how many people did. And that felt like the gift. That was the special gift. And I remember someone saying, the divorce will be the best thing that'll ever happen to you. And it's fucking true. Apart from the kids. You always have to say that. Apart from the kids.
Love my kids. And the thing that I love about you is that, you know, sometimes you can feel, I think when you're on the beginning of the, you know, there are people out there whose hearts have just been broken and they feel like life is never going to be okay again. And you feel, you know, you hear people like you and I say that, and it feels like, are they just saying that because that's the shit situation they've happened to be in? But actually, you know, the thing about you is it feels so authentic, and I hope it feels authentic about me. It does give you another shot at life, another shot at happiness, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And I there are mornings as I wake up thinking, I'm so fucking happy. This is wonderful. What a beautiful life I have. And I feel really, really, I hate using the word blessed, but I just feel like it has been the prize that I've always needed. And, you know, I just remember just in the beginning, I just thought, you just concentrate on all the things you're missing out on. You think, oh, we're not going to retire together, or da 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 da. And then one morning that switch kind of flicked the switch, and going, fuck, I can do anything I like. You know, I can go on holidays I like. I can eat whatever I like. You know, I can have 3 Mars bars for dinner. You know, it doesn't matter, because now my life is my own. And and that was wonderful. And I thought, oh, I don't have to look at his stupid cycling shorts or smell his socks, or, you know, you make a list of all the things that just completely fuck you off about men and him specifically. Yeah. And I thought, I'm free. This is a joy. And you know, I think, and look, I will look, let's be completely real. When I Googled the woman he had an affair with, I went, oh, her, gross. Yeah. So it made me feel,
I know that's part of the process, isn't it? And then you have to get all your friends to say that as well.
Yeah.
So would you say, in terms of sort of practically for people out there, in terms of healing, you obviously had a lot of therapy, you had some therapy with him and you felt heard. You called your friends, you drank wine. Yes. Was there, you know, exercise you didn't get into for later, but was there other stuff? Did you read a gazillion things, or was there?
Yeah, I found, especially on my days alone, I would download audiobooks and go for really, really long walks. So, like, I downloaded things like Glennon Doyle's Untamed, and Brené Brown was really helpful, Oprah, like any sort of soothing podcasts. And I think, you know, you don't have to do hardcore exercise, but actually just getting outside was really good, because it's so easy to wallow and there's too many reminders in your own house. And I think that was really good. And what I found really healing was talking to friends who'd gone through divorce, but also whose parents had gone through divorce. And actually, when you go through a trauma or something quite dark, friends will open up about their hard times, and then all of a sudden your friendships become much more stronger and solidified because of those moments of sort of sharing hard times. So I think that I found that really, really important.
That was one of the biggest gifts of my family. You know, I mean, I guess that it sounds like both you and I, and this is what I often talk to about people, you know, I did actually ask for help and I said, I feel really shit and I need this and I need that. And I think, you know, some people find it very hard to ask for help, don't they? But it sounds like you're like me, you can put your hand up and say, you know, I need to talk to someone tonight, or I need to, you know, I need help with my bank account or whatever.
Yes, exactly. And it's something to learn. I think there's something in us that we want to go, I can do this. It's fine. Yeah. But it's not fine. This is one of the shittest things that can happen to you. And when people say, what can I do? I said something like, can you just drop some like crisps and a packet of fags on my front doorstep? And they're like, yeah, of course I can. I was like, wow, this is magical.
In terms of the thing that I thought about you was, you know, you are going out on stage, you have an Instagram presence, you have a profile. How did you manage kind of keeping your shit together, keeping the show on the road, getting the kids out of the door, and as well, keeping this kind of public persona going?
Yeah, I think that was a bit difficult in the beginning, especially because I wasn't ready to come out. And so we kept going as normal. You know, Ellie and I would do Instagram lives on a Friday night. So we were producing content, and actually having a little bit of a distraction is not such a bad thing, and to channel some energy in. And also the work that I do intentionally tries to make people feel better about themselves. Like the Scummy Mummies has been going now for 9 years, and it's all about the messiness and the reality of parenthood. So to bring joy to other people actually fed me as well. I felt like I've got real purpose, and despite the fact that my marriage is in the toilet, I can give other people joy. And so I think that really kept me going. And and there were times where I was going out on stage thinking, fuck, I don't feel funny, but there's something in you, and you're like, well, literally the show must go on. And I was really buoyed by it. And when I came out about 3 months afterwards, Ellie and I did a podcast in the Gene. I was overwhelmed by how many women got in touch from around the world saying, thank you for talking about separation and becoming a single parent, because I know it is slowly changing, but also there's a massive stigma around being a single parent. And I myself very much, you know, had a great fear about being a single mum and thought I couldn't cope. But actually, I love being a single mum. I love it. And I think my relationship with my children is much better for it. And there's no conflict, you know, and all the jobs, yes, they're down to me, but they get done in my time, in my way, and actually doesn't feel
prioritized in your way. Yeah.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel like it. And, you know, there's less washing to do, obviously. But, you know, half the time I do those jobs anyway, so it didn't feel like it. And all those milestones like the first birthdays and Christmases and all that sort of stuff were a fucking joy. They were absolutely lovely, because no one saying, oh, you're doing it wrong, or there's no expectations. You create your own traditions and your own new experiences and memories. And that's what I loved. And the sort of things like on my first holiday, I went to Southwold, because that's where we used to go as a family. And I thought, no, fuck it. I want to re-own Southwold. I'm not going to go there and go, oh, God. I was like, no, it was important for the kids to have familiarity. And I was like, no, this is our place now. You fuck off.
Yeah. And I think that it's so much of it. And it's very hard if you're out there and you know, you find that very hard. But if you put that spin on it, and then you can, you know, you then start to believe it. And I remember a moment just like yours when I locked the door and I sort of locked us in at night, which was always kind of my husband's job. And I just felt this kind of peace. And I was like, actually, there's, you know, there's the three of us here plus my mum in the annex, you know, and the dog and the guinea pig. And I just felt a real sort of sense of like, this is enough, you know, it is enough. But back to your earlier point, I think there is, you know, I grew up in a single parent household, and, you know, I think my mum definitely felt that there was a sense of shame and stigma around it. And I do think that is 100% changing. And I hope that by us being out there and meant, you know, other voices saying, actually, it's okay. You know, it's okay. And it's certainly better than being in a relationship that doesn't serve you, you know.
Exactly. And exactly. I reckon my children are much more proud of me. You know, I'm not going, oh, here's another bins. And this is, you know, they're not seeing that conflict. I'm just going, come on, we're all going to strip the beds today. We're all going to get on with it. Mummy works hard. I work hard to earn money. And we're a team now. And I do feel that there's no sort of friction or fractions in the house in terms of, oh God, when is he going to do that? And there's no expectations like that. So I think that's really good. And they see that I'm strong, but also they see when I get sad and things are too much and I'm tired and I'm like, no, you know, we've all got to work a bit harder. So I think there's a great benefit to that as well. And we're not perpetuating any stereotypes. And I have great conversations and the kids still talk to me about the divorce. And I want that conversation to keep going because their grief isn't linear and neither is mine. And I think that's really important because I think it's easy to kind of shy away from the tricky discussions, but I don't think in the long term that's of any benefit to anyone.
No, and actually when you were just talking, you know, we were saying there were amazing things about being a single mum, but, you know, there's no doubt, is there, that it is really hard for the children. You know, that moment you were describing about telling them and, you know, is that, you know, they are having to grapple with something major and there are benefits, but there are, you know, it's a big, you know, I try not to, you know, my daughter will kill me if I talk about it too much, but, you know, they have both struggled with it, obviously. Mm.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, their father had an affair and then he quickly moved into another relationship. And so they were still grieving the loss of him in the house and things like that. And then they've had to very grown up, you know, to accept a new woman in their lives as well. So I think that's really hard. But I've started dating and they're fascinated. Yeah. So my kids have only met someone I've dated like once and it was at my book launch. And so I'd invited him along. We're now friends. We'd sort of dated and we still see each other occasionally. But yeah, that I've very much kept it. And it is still less than 2 years since we separated. I thought they don't need that. And when I have them for 5 days, it is all about them. And then on the other 2 days, I can fuck anyone I like, obviously, and have a lovely time. Get it all in all the holes. But you know, I think I like that. I like that my life is very much kid time and then Helen the single sex pot on the other 2 days. And I think that for me is great because I don't want that to be changed anyway. And maybe when I do have a more serious partner, I can. But my daughter.
Do you think that they, because I feel that with the, you know, when they've had such an, you know, their life has been destabilized effectively. And so they're so reliant on you for stability is how I feel a bit about it. That actually, you know, the idea that you might leave them for someone or you might, you know, that your attention and your love might be taken away. I feel that they're particularly vulnerable to that. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. And they need to know that they're my priority. They need to know that they're number one, that, you know, everything is about them. But my daughter she's sneaky. She occasionally sees my WhatsApps and she's like, oh, who's that guy? Who's that guy? Who's that guy? And I was like, oh, just someone. And then she sat me down one day and she said, listen, mum, you've got all these boyfriends. And they're not boyfriends. They're just lovers. And she said, mum, you know, eventually you're going to just have to choose one of them and tell the other ones that you can't see them. And she was 12 at the time. I said, no, I don't. I can have as many boyfriends as I like. There's no rules. And then she said, fine, have three.
Okay, I love that. She's setting you some boundaries. Yes, exactly. And I mean, I think we have to get on to dating. So are you, like, has that been liberating, amazing, sad? You know, like kind of how has that panned out for you?
I've had some of the most extraordinarily romantic and exciting dates. And some have lasted like one or two dates. Others I've seen on and off for 6 months and things like that. But you know, I have felt liberated and I felt sexy and I felt desired. And one of the most heartbreaking things I found out when my divorce was, I said, look, you never said I was beautiful. And he said, well, that's because I didn't think you were beautiful. And I was like, oh, now you tell the fucking truth. Jesus Christ. Oh what about lie about that? And that was devastating. That was really devastating not to think that the person you were married to found you attractive.
I mean, do you think you can trust what he's saying there? Do you think it's like, because I think people just, you know, like it's almost like people lose their minds a bit or he, you know, so do you believe that, do you?
Yeah. Absolutely. To have a young man tell you you're sexy or, oh, I love your tits. I mean, I'm here for that all day, Rosie. I really am.
Oh, 100%. And I do think, you know, that's, for me, that kind of...
It's the joy of life. It's the joy of life. But also, what I love is that I feel so fulfilled in my career with my friends. I love my little house and my children. Is that when I have an interaction with a man, you know, and I might have a date every other weekend, it's just about pure attraction and fun and sex. And I don't need a man for anything else. And that for me is very liberating about dating in your 40s, is that I, you know, if I scroll through the dating apps, I'm like, I'm not looking for a husband or a future father of children or looking for a man with a stable job. You know, I've had dates with like baristas and like creatives and all sorts. And I think I just want to have fun with you for the night. And I think my list of priorities about what I'm attracted to and what I need have completely changed. And so,
I think that's such a modern viewpoint on it. And I think, again, it goes back to that thing we were talking about earlier, which is that, you know, the sort of old-fashioned views of like, if you're single, then you must, you know, and if you've been left, then you must be devastated and that sort of stuff. And, you know, I think some people will find it like, can that really be the way you feel? And that is the way you feel. And how brilliant is that? Because I think lots of people try to tell themselves to feel that way, you know, have sex like a man in inverted commas. But it sounds like you are genuinely owning that and loving it.
Yeah, and I do like that. And, you know, there are times where I catch feelings for people and going, oh, I could have a relationship with them. But also, I'm kind of not ready. And also, I'm still really scared, if I have to be honest. I think there is there's almost an emotional safety in having flings, because you're not committing, they're not meeting your kids, all those sort of things. And I have to admit, I'm still scared of someone cheating on me or all that sort of thing. And so when I flip between lovers and things like that, there is a slight detachment, because I'm going, oh, well, it doesn't really matter. But then if I do catch some feelings for people, then that's when it gets hard. And of course, I've been ghosted by people, like, I think, oh, I had a lovely date with them. Love to catch up again.
And then how do you deal with that? I just did a post on that, actually. Can you sort of just kind of compartmentalize that and rationalize it?
I have to kind of have a bath and listen to some sad music and go, oh, they want me. And then I let those feelings go through, because that's normal. If you try and fight them, then you can't. You're not a robot. And then I just kind of take a step back and go, right, look at what I've got. If he didn't want me, then he's a bit of a dickhead anyway. And do I really want to be with that person? You know?
Yeah.
But it's the sting of rejection. And that's what's hard. And it's like, it's really not that hard to write a text message going, look, I had a lovely time, but, you know, I'm not in the right place or, you know, I don't want to see you again or whatever. It's not knowing. And I think silence is really cruel. It's really cruel. And I've had dates with guys who go, oh, I'd love to see you again. I go, look, I had a really lovely time, but I don't want to waste your time. I didn't feel there was any kind of sparkle, but all the best. You're lovely. You know?
Yeah.
Lovely, lovely, lovely. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.
And that's essentially good manners, isn't it? And also you kind of you got to take a deep breath before you send those messages and be the better person. But obviously some people just aren't able to do that, which is, you know, their loss. But there is a sort of process that you have to go through. It sounds like it's working.
Exactly. And also, like, you know, I've dated men who are 29, I've dated men who are 50. Like, I decided that I wanted to kind of experience, because I started my relationship with my ex-husband when I was 19, so I never dated, I've never had that experience. And I wanted to meet a variety of men. And my friend said to me once, isn't it great your husband left you when you were still really fuckable? I was like, yes, it was. What a lovely gift.
Thank God for that. And what about, I mean, I would think we need a word on the sort of young men that kind of appear from everywhere. I mean, that's such an interesting thing that I don't think anybody would really anticipate, that, you know, you kind of, you're sort of deluged by messages from sort of 25-year-olds.
Yes. And in the beginning, I was like, and I have my age, like I am 43. Yeah. And I'm like, are you sure? Are you sure? And I said, listen, I'm a curvy blonde Australian, quite loud lady. And they're like, yeah, bring it on. I'm like, yeah, bring it on. So I was always quite upfront about, who I am and my age and things like that. And yes, I was incredibly surprised by these 29-year-olds who were who were after it. But you know, it's a nice match of energy. And also we're both in it for the same things. They don't want to get married. I don't want to get married. And there's a nice kind of mutual, I don't know, want, need from each other.
It's certainly fun.
Yes, so, it is.
Fun is the word. So I guess, you know, one thing that I, last week I interviewed Vanessa Feltz, who was amazing. And I just asked her at the end, I said, what would you say to yourself now, the self that was kind of, you know, in that first period of shock, how would you advise yourself to get through that time? And I guess give hope for how it will turn out eventually.
Yeah. And I think it harks back to what you were saying about asking for help and admitting that you're broken. I think that is something I would tell anybody. And also have a large, if you can, array of support group and have different friends for different purposes. And I say this in the book, it's like the Spice Girls. You need someone who you do exercise with, who's like, right, get off the couch, get off the sofa and come for a walk with me. And you need someone who is quite bossy and who says, have you contacted the lawyer? Have you sorted your pension out? You need a variety of people that you can kind of go to for all those different things. And you need your boozy mate and you need your big bosomy cuddly mate as well. And so I think that would be my big advice. And and just understand that you can do it. It all, like when you get form E, which is fucking awful.
Yeah.
Where you have to like outline all your money and all the things that just, I put that off for a couple of weeks and I go, I can't do it. I can't do it. It's like, yes, you can, because every other woman has done this before you.
Yeah.
And there is so much information out there. And there's a lovely Laura Nazer, who's the family lawyer on Instagram. And there's so much, and there's the Gingerbread Charity for single parents and things like that. But also just be easy on yourself. And it doesn't matter if the house is a bit messy or the kids eat fish fingers three nights in a row, all that sort of stuff. I think, and just give yourself the love that you would give a friend.
That's such good advice. I think we're so hard at that.
Yeah, we're all good at being good friends, but actually the way we treat ourselves or the way we talk about ourselves, and you are very lovable. You are very lovable. Just because one dickhead made a mistake or several mistakes doesn't diminish your worth. And you are not somebody because someone else loves you.
Helen, thank you. That is like the perfect thing to end on, because I just, everything that you've said, I wholeheartedly agree with. And I now think I will be pursuing you to be one of my Spice Girl friends.
come in. Aussie Spice.
God, I don't know which one I'd be, slightly worryingly. But Helen, thank you so much. And congratulations on your amazing book and the fact that you give hope and inspiration to all these women. And I'm so grateful for you for talking to me today.
Oh, thank you for having me on my show. And the feeling is incredibly mutual. You're beautiful, strong and inspiring, Rosie. And thank you. It's the Rosie and the Thorn. I mean, how's that?
Love that. The Rose and the Thorn. Love it. Brilliant. Thank you, Helen.
You have been listening to Life's Rosie, a Viral Tribe production. I'd be so grateful if you could like and subscribe wherever you currently listen to your podcasts. To find out more about what Viral Tribe are up to, go to tribe.fm. That's tribe with two I's.fm. Sign up and join the podcast revolution. Thanks for listening.